Welcome to another conversation around Play the New Game. My name is Mitch Axelrod. I'm going to be your host, your guide, and your chief encouragement officer for the next half hour, 40 minutes that we spend together. So I want to thank you all for being with me today. This is a very unique kind of conversation, although I feel it may be one of the most important conversations that I will ever have. I feel like it could very well be a turning point, a pivotal point, and certainly the way the world is today, with so much turbulence and so much change and so many challenges, there's probably never going to be a better time to sit down and talk about issues of peace and values and essentially living spiritually in what really is a material world. And so I want to thank you all for joining. We're going to keep the line open for this call. And again, if you have any background noise, just hit the number 6. But what I would love to do is those of you who are on the line are obviously attracted by something in this conversation. If you could, in a minute or so, kind of give me a sense of what brought you to this conversation, because this is a conversation that, although making money seems to attract the most people into conversation lately, similarly to the way that the economy now is dominating the conversation at a national level and pushing what I believe to be the most transcendent and existential issue of our time off the front page, which is the issue of peace and war, and not just peace and war on a global level, but how peace and war reflects who we are from the inside out. And this extends not just to the new game of life, if you will, but it also extends to the games of business, the games of money. And so I today would like to share some things about values, my perspectives, and I would absolutely invite and welcome and encourage you to do the same, because this is a conversation I believe that's long overdue. It's happening in pockets around the country, but it's not happening with any momentum, and it's really evidenced, you know, by the fact that we had more than 100 people on the first couple of calls, which were predominantly business calls, although we ventured into some great areas of money and life, and yet a conversation like this, you know, only gets a handful of people, and so. I would very much love for you to share with me what brought you to the call, and actually, what do you hope to get out of the call? And in that conversation, you could include a challenge that you have or anything you'd like to say. But if you could take about a minute, I would very much appreciate you sharing what brought you here, and that'll give us a context for continuing the conversation. So if a couple of you at least would be willing to do that, I'd appreciate it. So somebody wants to jump in.
My name is Stan Kaminsky from New York.
Yes, Stan.
And the reason I'm on the call is I haven't been privy to the other sessions that you did this week. For some reason, I just kept missing them. But the reason I'm here today is because I'm back into the game, and I need to jumpstart myself. And as far as I'm concerned, you, Mitch, are someone that every time something comes up with your name attached to it, I'm drawn to it. Well, and that's why I'm here, just to find out what you have to share today that I can, you know, be inspired by, really, to use a term like that.
Well,
that's
Stan,
what I'm doing here today.
Thank you very much, Stan. I really appreciate you being here, and so thank you for jumping in. Anybody else want to share what drew them to this conversation?
Yeah, Mitch, it's Peter here.
Yes, Peter.
I'm in the UK, as you know, and I'm sure it's probably much the same where you are in the States, but there's been such a deterioration of common values amongst the population, and you see it most evident in youths with youth crime and, you know, kids going to school 14, 15, carrying guns, having knives on them all the time. And there's just been this total dilution, if you like, of values. And I just believe that the politicians aren't doing enough, and that maybe in business we can actually do something to accelerate this reacquaintance with basic values and getting back to some form of respect and honor, which just seems to be watered down so much. So my reason, and as with Stan, anything with Mitch Axelrod on it carries a bit of weight with me. I've got respect for you, and I think that the discussion will be meaningful. That's why I'm here.
Oh, God, thank you very much, and bless you for joining us. Thank you, Peter. Anyone else want to chime in?
Yeah, this is Clay. Clay Cotton. Yeah, Clay Cotton. And I'm always drawn to you, Mitch, as you know. Primarily, the appeals to me is the work on values. I feel values are so darn important and so given so little attention, our value systems and what goes on inside. That's number one. Number two, being drawn to this, the word peace really attracts me always. Number one, I'm working with my on a website with my buddy called GandhiGuy.com, and we're exploring at GandhiGuy. We're exploring the power of peace in society and primarily internally in everyday life and in our internal world, and also with the idea of stopping the waste of money going to warfare and the waste of energy and the harm and suffering that that causes. I've got another buddy that goes around Bosnia and Europe picking up landmines that were left behind years ago when there was civil strife there and that high-tech warfare came in and little kids are getting their legs blown off of there from landmines that are left around. So these things are real tangible reasons to be focusing on peace, which is an inner situation. It starts within each one individually. Also, I'm an old ex-hippie from San Francisco, from the old days of Haight-Ashbury and Flower Child, and so peace and love always resonate with me. I think that for one thing, human beings have been for 4,000 years over concerned with warfare and fighting and conflict, and I think that as Buckminster Fuller pointed out, we've got enough to take care of the basic needs of all humanity with stuff left over, so there's no need to compete for resources quite the way that we have all these years, and there's ways to work together and collaborate, and the internet is starting to show that this world is flat and we can collaborate and work together in some ways. I like to say grid, not greed. So instead of working off of greed and competition, we grid together and work together. Grid instead of greed.
Yeah, that's great.
And I used to speak when I was doing public speaking. I can't get out of my house much anymore because I'm down to a wheelchair. But when I did do public speaking, I was very big on the love-based marketing, which I coined this phrase, love-based marketing, and have the same problem that no one is interested in love-based marketing. Well, if they're not interested in love, then what are they for?
Yeah.
What's, you know, if you're not for love, so if you're not in business to love your consumer, love your client, love your customer, love your market, and achieve unity and oneness and intermarry with their wants and needs and desires and whatnot, then what? What do you want to just maximum extract suck the money out of their wallet like a Hoover on steroids, you know, crazy greed.
And that's
issue.
Exactly the context in which I really want to talk today, and I'm glad you brought it up. And I also want to put a plug in for Clay. And if any of you want to listen to some really great piano playing, this man spent some time with the likes of, well, I'll let you tell him. who you play piano. Just rattle off five or six names.
Well, I was just really lucky. It was
no, come on, just the names. Just give me the names. Don't
well,
no false
okay.
humility here. Come on, throw them out there.
Well, I mean, I'm really grateful. I got the opportunity to share the stage with Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jerry Garcia and Boz Scaggs and Bonnie Raitt and John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters, Charlie Musselwhite.
Oh, man.
A lot
it's
of
like a who's
the posters,
who.
The Drifters.
Yeah, it's like a who's who. You just, I'm so.
I got cool. around.
You did. And,
I
and,
got around.
I met Clay about 10 years ago, I guess, and he's truly one of the great spirits. And it's interesting that you mentioned love-based marketing, because I really want to talk about really what this whole social marketing movement is moving toward. And I also want to give a context based on the values work that you mentioned earlier. So, but before I do that, and if I ask anybody else to please share, would you, Clay, give out the website where people can get your music?
Great. Well, the place to go find out what I'm up to includes music and my thinking on marketing and business and whatnot, which is expanding now.
Okay.
I'm starting. Go to claycotton.com. That's claycotton.com, and there'll be links there. Over always links over to the piano music.
Great. And I have some of Clay's stuff. It's just great music, and you'll be supporting a wonderful guy. Who will deeply appreciate, let's put it this way, you'll get plenty of love out of your $20 or whatever it is for the CD. So I wanted to acknowledge you for that, Clay. So thanks for joining us. Before I move forward, anybody else want to come on out and share what brought you to the call and anything else that you might want to talk about in terms of getting out of the call? Don't be shy. Okay. All right, so if I may, let me establish a quick context here, because obviously this is such a big conversation that we could do weekend after weekend after weekend. I mean, you could have the conversation literally for the rest of our lives, and I'm sure each and every one of us here will, because it's who we are, and it's how we show up in the world. And because we only have a half hour, let's say, to kind of synthesize this, I would like at least to open the door to conversation here. And certainly as the months go on here, I'm going to spend a lot more time drifting into, or I should say integrating, the values conversation with the business conversation, with the money conversation, and ultimately into the politics conversation. Because, you know, life is integrated, and all of those things affect each other. The seismic shift of the new game, as I see it, and as I've seen it now for 10 years, is interdependence. That is the major seismic shift and interconnection of everything. And as we've been talking about the past couple of days, you know, what happens in America doesn't stay in America. What happens in America has a ripple effect throughout the world. And right now, the ripple effect, the turmoil, the turbulence that the entire world is feeling is palpable. You don't have to turn on your television to see it. It's palpable. You can sense it. You can feel it. And for the past 17 years, I have been a student of and a teacher of what I consider to be the one of the solutions, one of the answers to the challenges that we face every day, not just in the world at large, in the world outside of us, but in our own inner world. And the context that I wanted to create around the conversation today was the juxtaposition of inner peace and outer peace. That is it possible that we can still maintain a sense of inner peace even while the world is blowing up around us? And some of us are engaged in this awareness more than others, and some of us are not, and I'm not here to judge that. All I do know is I resonate with each and every one of you, and I agree wholeheartedly with what you all said, particularly how, Peter, you languaged it about the decay of our values. And values have been something that was pounded into me from when I was very young. I'm the youngest of 8 kids. My parents were yours, mine, and ours family. And we grew up with a very, very firm foundation of human values. And what's interesting is I now pass that along to my son, as we all pass along to the next generation. And I'm very concerned and worried about the next generation. I'm 53 years old. I'm concerned and worried for myself, trust me. And I'm concerned and worried that our legacy is not going to be how much we leave in money or wealth or material things, but whether we leave our children and our grandchildren a world that's really worth living in. I won't share this story today. I'm going to share this story probably on a future call. But about a little over a year ago, my son Adam and I had a really important conversation that changed the trajectory and the arc of my life, literally transformed the way I see my entire future. And it related to the state of the world as we're in today. And it's not just the state of, this idea that peace is somehow naive, that it's fanciful, that it's Pollyannish to think, sit around and even on the media, they mock it as if, we're going to all stand in a circle and sing Kumbaya. To me, that's the height of condescension. To somehow elevate war to be valuable, to be acceptable, and to denigrate peace.
Philip Moran.
And so it seems that we're afflicted with this idea that everything is a competition, and everywhere we go, we have to win. And in order to win, if you have any background noise or if you're on a cell phone, you can just hit the number 6 on your keypad, and that'll mute out the background noise, because we're going to keep this on open mode. So if we can try to keep the line as quiet as possible, this way we can interact together. Thank you very much, and welcome to the call. And so what I want to do is I want to share with you some of the context of the values work that I've been doing, but I'm not going to give it to you in my words. I'm going to give it to you in the words of a man who is one of my greatest mentors, and although I never met him, he has had a profound effect on my life. Dr. Robert Hartman was literally the godfather of the human values movement, Incidentally, he was also the grandfather of the profit-sharing plan in America, and virtually nobody knows that. Something that today is so commonplace, profit-sharing, pensions, 401ks, IRAs, all of that evolved out of the mind and the intention of Dr. Robert Hartman. Dr. Hartman fled Nazi Germany in 1933, when Hitler was elected chancellor, because he was a magistrate who was putting a lot of Hitler's henchmen in jail, and they put a bounty on his head. Essentially, he was forced to flee the country. And so, I want to share with you what some of Dr. Hartman's words, because he spent his entire life, and here's how he described his work: to give us the means to recognize and fulfill the good within us, to enrich our lives and make the world a place of more goodness and peace. That's what he described as his life's work. And he framed his entire life's work around one question that led to a whole series of additional questions. And that one question was, having fled Nazi Germany, well, before it became Nazi Germany, but in the early stages, he asked if evil can be organized so efficiently as it was in Germany, why can't we organize good? Why is good so difficult to organize? And why is it that good people in history never seem to have as much power as bad people? And so he spent the rest of his life literally trying to understand what was it in the human psyche, in the human thinking, in the human value system that would enable evil to triumph over good, that would enable his country that he loved so dearly to allow a small group of men to essentially hijack the country. And he went on to ask a series of questions. And I'll share a couple of those questions with you right now because I think they really frame out the conversation very well. He said, why does a killer in war get a medal when a killer in peace gets the electric chair? In fact, that was the driving question that he spent his entire life trying to figure out the answer to. He also asked the question, is God truth, whatever your God may be, or is the military state the truth? What is the value of a human life? Dr. Hartman believed that war was madness. He said, I reasoned that peace must be rationality, and I rejected all violent creeds. He went on to say some interesting things further about the distinction between your natural birth and your national birth. He said, I am born by love and national by law. Whether you are a national or a foreigner depends upon the accident of your birthplace. For the state to value the accident of my birthplace higher than the essential of my birth itself seemed to me degrading and undignified. I was born to live for humanity. He went on to talk about the despair and grief of other people. He said, can I, who am loved and who loves, disregard the grief, the despair of the human heart, deliberately arranged for and by political power? Can I barter compassion for my fellow man for a mass of collective glory? The glory of the military state, won with the deaths of millions of men, women, and children, is not my glory. And then he talks a little bit about the distinction, which I'm going to share with you very briefly, and then I'm going to give you a couple of resources where you can explore this further if you like, because this is going to be a central theme of our conversation, and that is the hierarchy of human value, the hierarchy of values. Not only did he discover it, but he went on to prove it scientifically and mathematically, and as a result, he was nominated for a Nobel Prize in 1973. And he made a distinction here that is so critical, and it's so prophetic. He says, with law, you can make evil look good by making it legal. It is legal, though immoral, to incinerate millions of people in war, and you might even get a medal for doing it. But if you kill one person in peace, it isn't legal, and you may get the electric chair. It's a very profound distinction that he made. And so I'll kind of conclude these passages here with a couple of more statements that he made, and then I'd love to open it up to conversation as to how this relates not only to the global issues that are outside of us, because that's one world in which we live, the world outside of us, but also how does it affect the world inside of us, the inner game, so to speak, okay? And so he goes on to say that compassion, the power of our conscience, must grow from a local into a global power. We could have prevented catastrophe if our souls had been strong, our conscience awake, our compassion ardent enough to punish crimes as they began. He said that people in positions of power and influence are willing to sacrifice well-being and lives of individuals for extrinsic goods such as wealth, oil, jobs, power, territory, or social status, and systemic values like religious dogma, political ideologies, ethnic purity, national sovereignty, military glory. And he concluded by saying in this piece, perhaps we could recognize human values as sensitively as we recognize material values. Then perhaps human dignity and worth could in time triumph over human folly. Peace could prevail and civilization would be free to advance. This would have to be the case because either we know goodness, we know value, and we act accordingly, or we will perish. There is no other alternative. To me, and this is just a small piece of a very big project that I'm working on right now, which is to take Dr. Hartman's work. His autobiography was called Freedom to Live, and I'm going to essentially create a new work around it called Freedom to Live in the 21st Century, using a lot of what Dr. Hartman discovered in terms of not just the measure of values and the hierarchy of values, but also what are the consequences if we ignore what's going on around us. And what was interesting, I'll kind of end his words with this, because it was spooky, all right? He issued a warning that has proved to be frighteningly prophetic. He said, when he came to America because he said, America is the most fertile ground for the organization of goodness. America was the prototype of a civilian society with a minimum of military apparatus. And then he went on to issue this warning, and it gives me the creeps to even say it, but here's what he said. He said, America was not immune to the military virus. She could conceivably go the way of Germany, but I felt she could never confuse human values to the point of becoming militarized. But if ever she would be, I knew the delusion would be even more difficult to detect than in Germany, for America was born to be a world power, and militarism thus might fit her as a glove on a hand. And he said those words in the early 1960s. And here we are 45 years later, and it would be easy to make an argument that we have not detected this delusion, this virus that we've been infected with, and we're pushing very close to a point of no return. And so part of what I would like to talk about and invite you to talk about is, first off, how do those words resonate with you? How did it, what do they bring up for you? And then for the last part of this conversation, I'd like to talk about how do we bring a sense of peace, both inner peace and outer peace, but also how do we bring a heightened or elevated sense of value to the game of business, money, and life? Because that is the theme of this conversation, how do we play a new game, and especially in the games of business, money, and life. So does anybody want to comment on some of what I just shared?
Yeah, me. Clay.
Yeah, Clay.
I'll jump right in. I couldn't be more happy. I'm really thrilled and giddy to hear the level of articulation that you're bringing to this movement or this mission, Mitch, and referring us back to Dr. Hartman. I've felt for years that the work of your work in values, and the more I learn about Dr. Hartman, was the shining glory of what you do, and I'm just thrilled to know that you're moving in this direction to help spread the message and get the changes out there that absolutely necessary have happened. So I can't be happier, and I'm signing on as your first your first lieutenant or whatever. Just bring me along and let me do grunt work.
Oh, well.
Wash bottles and sweep the floors.
Well, there's plenty of sweeping that needs to be done, and we'll get into that in another conversation because you and I have talked about that, and that'll be part of another conversation we have about, you know, we can talk about this and talk about it and talk about it. The question is, what can we, is there something we can actually do about it? And
right.
I spent all of the last year trying to come up with some answers to that, and so I'm going to share more of that as the weeks go on. Thank you, Clay. Anybody else want to
One thing to add to that is we can start, I think it's better to start personally than it is to try to change the world. You know,
yes.
We change ourselves.
Yes.
And I think the place to begin with that is in languaging, because there's violence in almost all languaging systems, but I notice it most in English, in the evaluation, the evaluative and the judgmental aspects and violent aspects of languaging, which I hear in myself and in everybody I'm around, unless they've taken the time to examine their languaging and the symbols that they use to eliminate and the just the default knee-jerk violence. You know, I'm guilty of it myself, but it's happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can examine that as we go on with this conversation later on.
Well, I thank you for bringing that back to the internal game, because really that is really all we have control over. So I really appreciate your sharing that, and that language distinction too is critical. Anybody else want to jump in here?
Yeah, Mitch, it's Peter here.
Yes, Peter.
I think that if I can sort of relate from where I'm coming from and what my experience has been on the business side to what you've just said, I think there's a link between the two, and I think from a conditioning point of view, perhaps there's pointers towards the answer. I've found over many years, I've been doing executive coaching for 28 years now, and that the biggest single factor in helping people to be more successful is to understand their mindset, and that if they hold, if they hold often subconsciously, if they've got a mindset which contains limiting beliefs, then no matter how good the strategies might be, no matter how clear their goals, no matter how talented those individuals might be, they will never go beyond the limit of their subconscious beliefs. And when you can get people to actually align their subconscious beliefs with their conscious goals, then you've got the formula for success. And I just believe that, you know, what you were saying earlier about this mindset of people feeling that, the military solution is the only solution. And maybe there's a sort of belief there that if, in terms of, say, America, you're the world's number one power, maybe there's a sort of widely held belief that to maintain the power that we have, we need to be militarily superior to any others. In other words, it gets back to the competitive environment again, as opposed to the creative environment, which I think is the one that we want to nurture. I don't want to preempt what you're about to say, because I know you want to get into what we can do about it. But in a small way, I would like to believe that if we could do that with our youngsters in the schools, I'm dealing with business people largely, but I believe the problem lies in the schools and in the families. We've got three or four generations now who've been conditioned the same way to have eroded all these values, and it only gets back to beliefs again. If we can start instilling at an early stage within the schools the respect that used to be there, the respect for authority, the respect for human values, you know, then I think we would be getting somewhere. But that's got to start with converting people's beliefs or making them aware of how powerful their beliefs are to their behavior. Sorry if I'm getting on a soapbox here, but what I wanted to say.
I appreciate that. You know, this is the conversation has to be patient enough to you have to be willing to tell your truth, and you have to be willing to listen to other people's truth. So I very much appreciate your sharing as much as you need to share. I do want to make a distinction about what you said, because it's very apropos to what Hartman came to understand and came to prove. The world is a three-dimensional place, yet we spend most of our time acting and being in it as if it's only two-dimensional. And that two-dimensional world he called the systemic world, where everything exists in either I'm right or I'm wrong, it's good or it's bad, it's black or it's white, it's legal or it's illegal, all right? And what he said was that that is the lowest level of value. He called it systemic value, but essentially it's conceptual value, it's ideology, it's beliefs. And he made a powerful, powerful distinction that once you get the distinction and you integrate it into your own life, it has a profound effect, not just in how you live your life, but how you do your livelihood and how you make a living. And he made that distinction between value and values. He said that values are only one dimension of value, and that value is a bigger game than values. And the way he framed the distinction is that when you think of values, you think of beliefs, you think of notions, you think of ideas, you think of concepts, mission, vision, purpose. What all of that has in common is all of those things are conceptual. And anything that exists in the conceptual realm of value is what we commonly call values. Honor exists in that dimension, all right? Nationalism exists in that dimension, all right? You're nationalistic or you're not. In other words, you belong to a country, you're a citizen or you're not. And so that systemic level of value is the lowest level of value. And he said that when you elevate to the next highest level, you elevate from concept to reality. And that reality, anything tangible, anything real, anything concrete, is more valuable than an idea. And by the way, he proved all this. That's one of the reasons he was nominated for a Nobel Prize, was because not only did he prove it mathematically, but he created a model, a system, a way for us to measure, a tool for us to actually measure this. And it's something I've been using in my work for 17 years now. And in that world of concrete value, the reason that that world is more valuable is because it has greater dimensionality, meaning a two-dimensional concept isn't as valuable as a multi-dimensional, real, concrete thing. So the blueprint of a house is a concept of a house. It's very valuable, and it's critical to build the house, but it's not as valuable as the house itself. And if you needed shelter from the storm, and you had a choice between the concept of a house or an old beat-up shack on the beach to keep you out of the storm, the old beat-up shack on the beach is more valuable than the concept of a mansion, okay? Because the real thing is more valuable than the concept of the thing. And what he said was it's at the level of, and he called that dimension extrinsic value. And what he basically said was that anything extrinsic has more valuable than anything systemic. And it's at that systemic level of right and wrong, good or bad, which is where most of our battles, most of our competition comes, win, lose, succeed, fail. Everything in that dimension is framed as an either-or event. And so when you elevate beyond that, when we start to meet each other more at an extrinsic level of getting things done, making things happen, building things, that dimension of value is more valuable than our ideology. And he went even further. He said there's an even higher dimension, and that's the dimension of intrinsic value, of unique value, of irreplaceable value, of immeasurable value. And because that dimension of value is infinitely valuable, it's the highest dimension of value. It has the most value. And so in that dimension, you find humanity itself. You find compassion. You find spirituality. You find soul. You find intuition, that sixth sense. If the real world, the extrinsic world, is the five senses, the intrinsic world is the sixth sense. And so at that level of humanity, at that level of intrinsic value, what Hartman proved was that because it has infinite value, because it's unique, it has infinite value, that everything and anything intrinsic is more valuable than everything extrinsic. And he came up with a very simple model to live by, using this three-dimensional value proposition, if you will, or three-dimensional value model. He said there were two sides to everything I experienced, the national and the human. When the two collided, I always took the side of the human. So in other words, what he said, and it's a model that I've been bringing to business for 17 years, and I've actually framed it in different language. He says when essentially, if you want to look at this from a business perspective, the words I would use are love, serve, and obey. Love, serve, and obey. I wrote a blog post about this. I wrote it's actually going to be a mini book, and I talked a lot about this with John Assaraf when he interviewed me for his One Coach group. I said there's a model that comes out of values that if we could adapt it and adopt it to the business world, every business would transform in a heartbeat. Every business would transform in a moment. And that shift in thinking or that shift in hierarchy is obey the rules, obey the authority, obey the policy, obey the concept is the lowest level of human interaction. You know when you're serving a customer, or you know when you're being served as a customer, when somebody says to you, we're sorry, Mr. Cotton, but those are the rules around here, that person is operating at the level of obeying the company rules and completely ignoring the higher level of interaction, which would be serving the customer. So you could literally, I mean, and we've done this with companies, and the opportunity to do this is so staggering, because not only does nobody really know about this, but nobody understands the distinction, and once they do, they could completely transform an organization simply by teaching people the distinction of obey, serve, and love. So you could look at an organization, and you could literally help them make or save millions of dollars simply by teaching them a values distinction. That's how profound sometimes, you know, simple changes can be. One of the articles I'm writing, a blog post I'm writing, is about the importance of leverage and not the financial leverage we've been seeing lately, but the idea of Archimedes' quote, which is, with a place to stand, I can move the earth. All right, and we're going to talk more about that as we continue forward over the coming weeks, because what came out of my going into the cave last year personally after this conversation with my son was I actually came up with a place to stand where here in America we could actually make a difference. We could actually do something that could make a difference. And so when you apply this values model to a business context or a relationship context or a family context, when you look at the low level of obey the rules, you can transform the relationship simply by up-leveling to serve the customer, all right? And if companies just did that, we would not have seen in America a mass exodus of our service departments going to the lowest bidder. About 3-4 years ago, I spent almost a whole year doing radio interviews around one subject, and that is how we can stop exporting our customer service jobs to foreign to other countries by turning customer service from an expense center into a profit center. And the companies that saw that and embraced it had a whole lot less outsourcing going on than the companies that didn't recognize that customer service may be the most fertile ground for new business opportunity, more top-line revenue, and more bottom-line profit than any other customer leverage point in the customer relationship cycle. All right, and this is something that we hammer home. Tomorrow, I'm gonna actually invite everybody to eavesdrop on one of our Rainmaker meetings. We have a group of 10 people who are out there working with me privately to take the new game solutions to companies and show them how we can help them literally improve their top-line revenue and bottom-line profit, in other words, make rain, with virtually no out-of-pocket expense, all right? And I've done this hundreds of times with companies to the tune of about $2 billion over the past 25 years. One of the ways that companies can do it is by up-leveling from being a systemic company, a company that operates by policies and procedures and rules meant to oppress the customer, not meant to express the customer, and to up-level that corporate culture to a culture of service. And every single company that I've ever worked with initially was resistant to this because they assumed if they had a customer service department, they were providing customer service, all right? But the truth is, what was happening is they were providing a problem-solving department. They were not really providing customer care. And there was no attempt to advance the relationship. There's no attempt to upsell. There's no attempt to cross-sell. There's no attempt to get referrals. There's no attempt to find out if the customer wants to buy an add-on or whatever. In fact, many businesses, like hospitals, for example, and a whole lot of others, actually mandate that their customer service people get people off the phone in 3 minutes or less, if you could believe that, okay? Well, I can understand it in the hospital business, but there's a whole host of other businesses that are still stuck in this systemic culture that our rules are more important than serving a customer. Now, in about, I guess, 1999, 2000 maybe, another major seismic transformation occurred in the world of business, and that was what I consider to be the shift from the old game to the new game. And that shift created a whole nother level of potential human interaction that would literally transform a business. And up until that point in time, nobody ever talked about it because you didn't use these words in the same sentence, and that is business and love. All right? Business, I remember when I was doing corporate consulting with some of America's biggest financial services companies back in the 90s, early 90s, from about 1990 to 1996, you could not walk into the corporate office and talk about spirituality, love, anything kind of silly like that, all right? They didn't want to hear that. But you could talk profit. But once you got in the door, they didn't care how you got to Rome. They didn't care what kind of transportation you used. They just wanted to get to the destination. And I was among very first people in the consulting world that actually brought a spiritual process to the world of business. And it was based in, we didn't use the word love per se, but we talked about loving what you do. And I always refer to the definition that of selling that Wayne Dyer uses, which I think is fabulous. He says, fall in love with what you do and then sell the love. And so what became part of the new game of business was to not fall in love with your products and services, but fall in love with serving people. And if you fall in love with serving people, you will never lack or want for a living or a livelihood if you can just think of how many people in this world are craving service. Forget about the love part. You don't even have to go that far if you don't want to. But if you create an environment of loving service, you can pick and choose any industry you want, any audience you want, any product you want, any service you want. Those things are just vehicles of transportation to get people to a destination. You can provide, if you can elevate your game to be a loving service provider, you will always be in demand. And companies that begin to embrace this and that actually teach people the critical life and business skills of communication, of listening, of not only listening to hear with your ears, but listening to see with your eyes and to hear with your heart, those companies will transform the experience that people have. And when they learn how to leverage those different five leverage points that we're going to talk more about in the coming weeks, then all of a sudden businesses can see that they can actually do better by serving people from the very first time they meet them. And so to kind of bring this all together, I wanted to talk more about the idea of internal peace today, and certainly we can pick this conversation up a little bit more next week. But this work, this values model, this three-dimensional model has so many potential applications. And what I find most appealing about it is that it is based on the idea that if you want a really truly balanced life or a more balanced life, that the hierarchy is not obey, serve, love. It's love, serve, and obey. And that includes not only the people outside of you, but the people inside of you, you yourself, that if you love yourself, which we find a staggering, staggering number of people diminish their own intrinsic value, including yours truly, if you love yourself and you serve yourself, then you won't get stuck obeying the rigid thinking that Peter so eloquently spoke about earlier, that as powerful as your thinking is, you know, a mind can be a terrible thing. And when you throw an ego and combine it with the mind, it can make you out of your mind. And so Hartman gives us, his legacy is a values model that has application to transform every aspect of the human condition, whether and as far as I'm concerned, every game we play, whether it's the game of business, the game of money. You look at what happened in the economic meltdown in America over the past couple of years. It's a meltdown of values. It's greed. It's putting vanity above humanity. And in some cases, it's even putting insanity above humanity. And that's a perversion of values. And when you start to export a perversion of values to the world outside of you, very bad things can start to happen. And so part of my motive here today was to begin a conversation, but it was also to provide you with a very powerful values model that to this day is the gold standard and the only scientifically, mathematically proven hierarchy model of values that exists on the planet. And to be able to take that and use it in such a way where you can integrate it into all aspects of your life, whether it's, you know, personally with your family and your loved ones and your children, or it's in your work with your partners and your vendors and suppliers and customers and clients, or whether it's in the world at large. You know, when we look at expanding out beyond the shores of our own country and our own cities and our own towns, but how we interact with this global world that we live in. It was Hartman's dream that axiology would actually be taught as a model in everywhere around the world, that it had, you know, become ubiquitous enough that when people related to each other wherever they were on the planet, they would always know that humanity is more valuable than vanity and insanity. And so if we've stimulated your thinking a little bit today, if we've got you hopefully a little bit more positively inspired about the possibilities that we can turn around this deep values perversion that seems to be we seem to be afflicted with, the only way we could do it is exactly as Clay said earlier, you know, one person at a time, and we have to start with ourselves. And so I'm gonna close before I ask you to share your comments about today's conversation. I'll just close with one of my favorite songs. I'm not gonna sing it, but I bet Clay could play it. But I just want to close with the title, and that is "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding." So, how would you like to share your feelings about this conversation? Any value you got about this conversation? We have about 5 more minutes before we conclude. I would love to hear your thoughts, your feelings, and anything you'd like to say.
I'd like to quote a couple of quotes. This is Clay.
Mm-hmm.
First one is by Meher Baba. Love has to spring spontaneously from within, and it is in no way amenable to any inner or outer force. Love and coercion can never go together. But though love cannot be forced on anyone, it can be awakened in him through love itself. Love is essentially self-communicative. Those who do not have it catch it from those who have it. True love is unconquerable and irresistible, and it goes on gathering power and spreading itself until eventually it transforms everyone whom it touches.
And would you send that to me?
Sure, man.
All right.
I used to use it as my SIG file. I thought you might actually have it already.
Oh, I probably do, but I'd love for you to send that again.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And the second quote, which I like to link with this, is by Emmett Fox. If you could only love enough, you could be the most powerful person in the world.
Beautiful. Thank you, my friend. That was great. Anybody else want to?
Yeah, man.
Anybody else want to jump
yeah,
in
Mitch,
here?
Yeah, Mitch.
Peter?
Sorry? Yeah, Mitch, I just want to say thank you so much for a tremendously interesting talk, as I expected it would be. One of the suggestions I might make in implementing this, if you're taking this on board as, say, a model for yourself, what can I do to implement the values of love, serve, and obey? If you were to ask yourself every morning when you looked at your daily planners what you've got to do today, would it be an appropriate question to ask now, how can I add more love to that activity? How could I bring better service to that activity? And how can I do that by obeying the laws?
That's great. That's really a great series of questions. You could actually turn it into one compound question, but that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Peter.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's been wonderfully enlightening and informative as always.
Thank you.
Anybody
else want to share something?
I just want to say, this is a phrase I just came up with during this conversation. Color me human and count me in.
All right, man. Well, it only takes a small group of people. It's as I think Eleanor Roosevelt once said, something like, it's always a small group of people. Or maybe it was Margaret Mead. I don't have a quote in front of me. But it always starts with a small group of people who believe something is possible. And that's the brilliance of Hartman's hierarchy, is he recognizes the value of the idea and the importance of the spark of the idea And the other day, before I end, does anybody else want to share anything you feel you've gotten out of this conversation, value or questions or anything you want to contribute? Last chance. Okay. And the other day I was talking with Paul Hartunian, and we had a great conversation, and I ended with a quote, and I'm going to actually give you the actual quote, and it's from Richard Bach. He said, "You're never given a dream without also being given the power to make it true. You may have to work for it, however." And so I'm prepared to roll up my sleeves, and I'm prepared to do what our founding fathers were willing to do, which is they were willing to pledge their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor. And I think, well, you know, if those guys could pledge their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor, which, by the way, is a perfect model for the intrinsic, the extrinsic, and the systemic values. Your life is intrinsically valuable. Your fortune is extrinsically valuable. And your sacred honor is systemically valuable. And I find that incredibly synergistic and ironic that the founding fathers would use that as their living mantra for declaring independence. They didn't ask for independence. They didn't go up to the king and request independence. They didn't go beg for independence. They declared independence. And so I would just leave you with whatever it is that you want to make happen in the world, declare it. So thank you all for giving me the privilege of spending some time with you. Please feel free to let others know if you're getting value out of this. This is one big grand experiment, this daily Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern, where we convene to talk about some things that are relevant and meaningful. And so tomorrow, you'll get a notice on this, but we're actually going to do a special session. We're going to be invited tomorrow to eavesdrop on our Rainmakers conversation, and we're going to talk about how do you make rain, and the critical part of that process, which is how do you activate customers? In other words, how do you gain commitment from people to do business with you? So tomorrow we get back to business, but for today it was all about peace, love, and understanding, and I thank you and honor you for being so gracious to spend your time with me. Have a wonderful night, good night, and I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.
Thanks, Mitch.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.